I don't know what it is. Like in preschools, you could have 20 or 30 just wild animal children zooming around, and this teacher will just ring this little bell like that, and they'll all get quiet. So, it's good. It works.
So the thunder showers held off, and I saw everybody outside. It was pretty nice, wasn't it? Yeah. So we wanted to take a little time and check in with you. And you did a bit of practice right before lunch. And really the invitation was to take something, some challenging situation where you'd maybe been reactive, unwise speech, and then just see if by deepening the investigation, whether it would be possible to call on the kind of resources that you could do it differently. And I wanted to ask what you noticed, and then Rick and I would like just to explore any questions that might have come up from that. So we have our mic folks, I think. Michelle and David have the mics, and just raise your hand if you have something to share or something to ask.
Hi. This might seem like a broad question, but it struck me in thinking about, is it equanimity? Is this the word? Is there room for defense, appropriate self-defense in this situation? And for me, I feel like that's always the line I'm wondering where I'm, which side of it I'm on. Is this appropriate? Do I need to defend myself? Or am I being aggressive? Reptilian.
That's really maybe one of the core questions, which is people ask me all the time, especially when radical acceptance first came out, and they said, you know, if I'm just radically accepting it, aren't I going to be like this doormat and people are going to take advantage of me and, you know, and I won't be able to take care of myself? And in a very simple way to say it, that if we don't take the time to come home into presence, then our reaction in some way is going to perpetuate the cycles of violence, period. Once we do come home into what we're calling equanimity, which is just right this moment, pausing, not reacting, we can access the very wisdom and compassion we need to know how to act on our own behalf or to take care, to defend, whatever, but in a way that's actually wise. And there's all the difference in the world between having somebody come at you and reacting back and pausing and then responding in a way that takes care, but takes care wisely. So that's my as broad and generic a response. That the precursor to intelligent action is that pause where you're absolutely present with what's going on. Anything you'd like to add?
It's a wonderful question, and I had just a couple thoughts, happily bought by the time of Tara talking there. I think that's why Freud, you know, filled his pipe, because he bought himself some time to think. Let's see. A couple of things. First, it's just to observe that we have good examples around us. Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, Martin Luther King, Barack Obama, who communicate with a lot of equanimity. They don't do a lot of fist thumping and so forth, but the dignity and fearlessness of their communication and the gravity of it is extremely penetrating and powerful. So equanimity is, if anything, actually, it can aid the moral force of what we're bringing to bear. Second thing about equanimity that struck me, usually the issue is not that we're excessively railing against other people. We're mostly pretty tame monkeys. I think most of us would say that if anything, we tend to err on the side of self-silencing, self-inhibiting, because of a fear or concern about what the reaction will be to us and an avoidance of the unpleasant emotions that will arise based on the reaction to us we anticipate. So it's through, in a sense, a failure of equanimity that we inhibit and censor ourselves. So paradoxically, by being able to be more spacious about the reactions of other people, seeing them as multiply conditioned, dependently arising and disappearing, eddies in the stream, if you will, coming together and then swirling apart again, and not necessarily owning them as our own, right? Not losing kindness and compassion and virtue, which Tara and I will talk about in a moment too, toward other people, but not losing that still, not being so reactive to what their reactions might be, that frees us then up again to speak truth to power, if you will.
In this last meditation, at the end, you said, what are you looking for in the interaction? And I came to like love and like a deep sense of contact. And I find myself in this place very often. The idea of giving myself that seems really like quite the leap. What's sticking in my mind is this five positive for one one negative. If there's anything that you can say about how the brain works, I mean, this conditioning that it is going to come from the outside is really difficult to get past. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to that.
I'll say something and then ask Rick to talk about brains. It's really true that when we're caught in what I call the trance of separation, we feel young, we don't feel lovable, we don't feel like we can offer ourselves anything, we really want it from the outside because energetically we're feeling young and helpless and we need something. And so sometimes the very first step is just purely recognizing that's what's needed. And not being able to offer, it's like I need this, and right now I can't offer it. But there's a presence about that, and this is the magic of mindfulness and mindful recognition itself. That you don't have to do something more. I mean, it's nice if you can offer things inward, but even the recognition that I'm needing love right now, just that recognition. In the moment of recognizing, there's a shift in identity from the self that's the small self needing to the awareness that's noticing that. And in that shift, there's some space for tenderness to start arising. Now, it might not be such a full-blown arising that you can then hold your inner child, but you're on that track. Does that make sense? So begin with the purity of just recognizing, oh, that's what's needed. There's an amazing power to being able to recognize what the need is in the moment. It's the beginning of responding to the need. Yeah, thank you. It's a really important question.
Recently, I went through a period of being angry with myself that I still wanted approval. Right? And I thought, gee, Rick, you've been practicing for a while. What a loser. More disapproval, right? And then again, this goes to one of the nice takeaways of this more scientific part. Through understanding, through what I've read about evolution and so forth, which I'll be presenting a little later, I really came to appreciate how incredibly social we are as animals. We evolved to really care a lot about our reputation in small groups, because that was the basis of exchanges that we could count on with other people. And so we evolved to care about approval. So we really evolved. And when I realized that, I lightened up. I stopped disapproving myself that I still wanted approval. You know, and then it just became something increasingly to practice with as a phenomenon. But that's an example here that we really, there is, I think, a certain supply for the heart that is irreducibly social. It is irreducibly the love and regard and support and respect of other people. There's no way around it. Otherwise, we'd be like lizards who just don't care and eat their young. You know. So that said, so that's my first point. Here's my second point. I want to tell you, for me, being pretty trained like Tara is in a lot of personal growth methods, I personally think this is the number one method. It's to take in the good. In other words, it's to deliberately notice positive events, register them emotionally, have an experience of them, and then have it sink in. And to do that a handful of times a day, even a dozen times a day, can really fill the hole in the heart. So if you, like me, I don't know you, but I know me, there was a shortage of supplies when I was a kid. I ended up with a pretty big hole in my heart. Sometimes it looked like about the base of a construction skyscraper project, you know, like that big. But if every day you throw a few bricks in, after a few weeks you notice something, a few months you notice there's a major change, a few years you started to really feel that hole in your heart. And so I think every day gives us opportunities, little ones, where we're with people and you can feel in that moment they care about us. They're with us. They're for us. They respect us. They see us. They're attuned to us. They're present. A lot of them are small. Some of them are medium. A few of them are big. Those are gold. That's the banquet of life. That's the great opportunity to sit down with a big spoon, you know, and not just let it go by, but to really, out of being for ourselves, use those as opportunities to gradually fill that hole in the heart. That actually will tend to fill in what was missing when we were kids. You know, and that can make an enormous difference to us as we go on. And then increasingly we become like the camel. We're already full, right? And we have less need for external supplies. But for a while, to go out and look for those supplies, even ask for them. When I was younger, I would do this and I would kind of humorously annoy my friends. They'd say, you know, I like that thing you did. I'd say, what did you like about it? But I wasn't doing it out of clinging. I was on my own side. I was trying to fill the hole in my heart so I wouldn't still need it out there after a while. To me, see? And you don't have to do it for love. It could be, for example, related to experiences of weakness. So you look for opportunities to feel strong. Or maybe it could be related to experiences of not feeling valued. So you look for experiences of value. See what I mean? And you kind of know yourself what your own particular hole in the heart is, what the lock is. So then you look for the particular shaped keys that will go in and gradually fill that unique, specific hole in your heart. And that's a profound way to change the brain and change your mind and change your life.
Just to add maybe a context, what Rick is describing is like a skillful means where you are deliberately, intentionally looking, it's like to counter the Velcro thing, you know, you're really looking for the good. That is really powerful, and for there to be true awakening and transformation, the deeper context is the capacity to be absolutely present with how it is in the moment. And they go hand in hand. And I'm bringing that in because if you're leaving here and saying, oh, I'm going to go after all the things that make me feel good and fill in that hole, and in some way you forget that what actually allows that to work is this fundamental training in all the spiritual teachings to be absolutely present with the pain of the whole. That too. Because I can say for myself that it's in the moments that I stop trying to fill in or change or do anything, but I just say, ouch. The moment that there's an ouch, what happens in that moment is that there's a tenderness towards this life that arises that I can't get out in any other way. And that tenderness is more of an introduction to who I am than any amount of filling in a hole. The core process of awakening is a shift in our sense of who we are. And we all have a narrative about what's missing. So I'm saying this because I feel like there's a balance in what Rick and I are trying to offer to you, and that there is a level of skillful means by which we sense what's missing and we really consciously, out of compassion for ourselves, go for it. And there's also a level at which we absolutely stay present with the feeling of, ouch, something's missing, and discover a profound, vast presence that's bigger than any narrative we've ever had about ourselves. So I hope that offers a context that's useful to you.
Rick, this is a question for you. I've been really struck with the power of language and words in the mind, and how, you know, this has come up. Tara's RAIN, the acronym that you talk about a lot with RAIN, or even just saying yes instead of no, and how in those moments where you have a choice in terms of equanimity, how to react, that saying, you know, pausing or having some sort of mental cue or some sort of word can be really powerful. And I'm just wondering about what's going on neurologically. Why do having those words that we're sort of keeping in our minds, why do they have so much power to shape our bodily experience and emotionally how we react to a potentially triggering episode?
See, I answered that in maybe two parts quickly here. One part is that when we're really being with our experience, remember how I talked earlier about these three fundamental aspects of practice, working with, being with, and transcending. When we're really being with our experience, particularly in a context that's transcended in a sense of, there's a sense of the unconditioned that's holding this conditioned experience, that's usually very nonverbal. And it has a very visceral power to it. So it's not just words that have power. Being with has power as well. On the other hand, one thing that has really motivated me personally, and then also as a teacher, is around this notion of efficacy, that there are things we can do, there are things we can work with to do through skillful means over time. It has to be grounded in this foundation of being with and transcending, but there are things we can do to fill the hole in our heart or to help regulate ourselves, as this quote says, Zoni Palmo talks about, with other people. And one way into that is through the power of language. Words have a particular power. We are very linguistically based creatures. There's a lot of research these days. One of the phrases is called reflective reprocessing. It's kind of, psychology is really good with nice precise language of what we already know about, you know, where we reflect and we reprocess. And a lot of that is benefited by language. Naming things, giving ourselves guidance and instruction. One time I nearly drowned, trapped in kelp, and just at the end of this period of panic, I was 16, the phrase, cool it, arose in my mind, you know, and that's what happened. So there is a power of language. On the other hand, I think implicit in what Tara was saying a moment ago is to be careful about it. You know, language, I think to use the Buddha's metaphor, is like a raft. It's skillful means, it gets us across the stream of suffering. But when we get to the other side, you know, we don't keep carrying the raft around on our heads. We want to move beyond language and not be caught by it. If you look at the people that strike me as profound teachers in writing, one thing that characterizes their teachings is they're very concise. And they've kind of moved through language to the other side of it. I want to say one more thing. I think it's important to be careful with words. For example, in Wise Speech, I mean, the Buddha basically said four conditions for sure, a fifth usual, an option, but optional. You know, say what is true, timely, beneficial, not harsh. That's the key one. And, if possible, want it. Right? Right? So the point is that really being careful about language, like I was careless in my language in my email to my wife, and it had consequences. They weren't big, thank goodness, but I was careless. I think being thoughtful about the words we use with other people and not being needlessly inflammatory is good. The last is, what are the language do we use to ourselves? Many people have observed we're very harsh, you know, in the way we talk to ourselves, and being thoughtful about the words that we use to ourselves.
Yeah, during the meditation before lunch, I had a hard time thinking about any recent episodes where I had responded to a trigger. I think maybe when the button being pushed is very small, I might have some equanimity. But I was thinking further back, when a really big button is being pushed, I also don't react. But I think it's because I want to avoid conflict. I want to avoid escalation. And my motive when I do that is to avoid the possibility of losing the encounter and to buy myself time to plan some kind of retaliation, some kind of passive-aggressive retaliation later. but then sometimes what happens is that buys me time to start thinking about it and to start looking at the other person with some compassion and thinking, you know, and letting that a little bit of equanimity come in so that, you know, it defuses everything and I end up not planning the retaliation. But then the next step is that sometimes it doesn't make me feel completely at ease because I sometimes question, was my motive just to avoid future conflict, or was my motive, was I really, you know, had I really achieved some equanimity through the process? And, you know, sometimes I feel okay that way, and sometimes I'm, you know, still conflicted about it. And I don't know if It doesn't sound like a very skillful means, but I just wonder if you had anything to say about that.
It sounds to me like we sometimes forget the freeze response, but we, you know, typically when we're aggravated, we either, you know, fight or run away in some way, and freeze is the third one that we do. And it's very, it's got a really good reason for existing in animals and humans, because in the freeze, we are actually given time. Our predators will think, oh, no problem with that one anymore. I don't need to kill it. You know, we can get away in the freeze period of time. Sounds to me like your intentions are mixed, which is really a very valuable thing to see. And part of it with the freeze is, oh, I have the opportunity to come into a wiser, healthier response. And part of it is probably a lifelong way of self-protection that comes from the fear of acting, that you'll get punished for your human response. To the degree that it's the latter, it's just going to serve you to keep on paying attention, like to invite those energies up that are afraid of really being fully who you are or being out there for fear of, and just bringing a really curious investigation to that. Because in some ways you've made the best out of your freeze response, but there might be still some streams of it that want attention. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to share a thought in regarding to what you said about staying with the emptiness. And when I came to the States, you know, the notion that my needs that need to be taken care of first was very strong. So I swung as a pendulum to that sense. It's like, okay, it's me. I have to be taken care of first. And then, you know, as I started going to the middle and going back to my paradigm, it was like, wait a second. Not all my needs need to be met. There's no such rule that says that. Nor does it say that, you know, I have to be comfortable all the time. And I began to struggle with that notion in my environment, because the message that I still get in the States is your needs have to be taken care of first. And my being says, uh-uh, that's not how the world works, you know. So anyway, part of that compromise that I need to make, not to have all my needs met, would be to stay with the emptiness. That was my interpretation.
Yeah, emptiness is a little bit of a difficult word, but there's an insight that you're that I'm hearing, and a wisdom, which is what we feel of is an imperative need. Like, it's part of our narrative. Like, I can't be happy unless da 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 da. That's really worth challenging. Like, who would you be if you didn't believe that? Who would you be if you didn't believe that you had to have this need met? And I feel like that's what you're coming to, which is there's a deeper space that you can live in if you don't feel like, oh, I don't have to buy into that. I don't have to go meet that need. And that space is what you might be calling emptiness, where you're not hitched. So just to say more generally, part of the invitation in this, when we get reactive, is to examine, what am I feeling? What am I needing? And what am I believing? What am I believing? And who would I be in this moment if I wasn't believing that? There's a lot of freedom that comes with that.
I want to say one more thing about dealing with upsets with other people, because that's, in a way, what we've been talking about. It's to feel a compassion for how this moment is hard for them, too. And to actually feel it, you know, to look in their eyes and see the being behind the eyes who is scared, worried, going to die, upset, contracted, setting the conditions, even if in the moment they're gleeful and gloating, they're setting the conditions for their own suffering. And somehow it doesn't make it so bad when we have some sense of how they're suffering too. And it also helps us not make matters worse by having some sense of compassion for them. I think that's practical. The second thing is this famous parable from Taoism. I'm going to tell it to you. It's the parable of the log. And I'm going to update it kind of quickly here. It's that, imagine that you're in a canoe with your sweetie. On a Sunday afternoon, you decided to have a picnic. It's a wonderful day, and you decided to get all dressed up. You're all dolled up, etc. And you got your picnic with grandma's special super-duper silverware, and everything's going great. And suddenly, boom, there's a loud thump to the side of your boat, and it tips over your canoe in this slow-moving river you're in and dumps you into the cold water. You come up sputtering, your clothes are wrecked, or the silverware's at the bottom, your food is wrecked, your sweetie's, you know, bobbing away. What do you see? You see three teenage boys with snorkels have snuck up on your boat and shoved it over, and they're laughing. How do you feel? That was a good gesture. Right, okay, right? That's how you feel. Okay.
The Taoist talked about snorkels?
Well, I updated it. You know me, I'm modernizing this. Okay. So now, take two. Everything's the same. You're in the canoe, it's Sunday, it's on a picnic, you're all dressed up, it's all great, you did your hair, everything's perfect. You're in the canoe, grandma's silverware, loud thump, boom, dumped in the water, all cold, hair's wrecked, clothes wrecked, silverware at the bottom of the river, come up sputtering, what do you see? You see this big submerged log has drifted downstream, smacked into your canoe, and tipped you over. Okay, it's a log that did it. How do you feel now? Yeah, it's the first dart. You're in the water. Yeah, but it's not so, you're not so angry about it.
Then I'm blaming myself for not seeing the log.
Oh, but then you're blaming yourself for not seeing the log. There's a little bit of that too. But one of the key differences is the log did not pick on you particularly. They didn't do it deliberately. And the thing is, in life, we go through life and things bump into us. All kinds of first darts happen from other people. All kinds of other people are first darts in our life. And we think they're picking on us deliberately, when in fact, most of the time, we're just a bit player in their drama. They're just a log. They're just a log launched by 10,000 causes upstream, banging into us. They're just a log. Yes, we should get out of their way. Yes, we should deal with it skillfully once it happens. Yes, we might start thinking about, this river has a lot of logs in it. Maybe it's time to pick a different river, right? But to start seeing people in this way and to be very careful about what psychologists call the attribution of intentions to other people, the intentions we attribute to other people. My wife sends me this email. She's not thinking very much about it. I attribute this intentionality to her, that she's uncaring, she's dismissive, she doesn't want me, you know, maybe she, whatever. You know, suddenly I'm experiencing a lot of second darts right there. You see the distinction? And to start to appreciate how other people are log-like. And not take it so personally. That's a really useful thing. Okay. So I want to talk about empathy now. First, what is empathy? Empathy sounds like a fancy word. It's a very simple thing, actually. We sense and we feel and we understand what it's like to be another person. Typically, there's both a bodily resonance and some kind of conceptual understanding. It's not either or. They both tend to come together, and they inform each other. In other words, our bodily resonance to the feelings of another person gives us things to think about. We think about them. We also know what we know about the other person. We form a theory about them that then kind of informs how we look inside to what resonates in our gut about what the other person is feeling. The two go together. Empathy is for positive states as well as for negative states. We often talk about how it's only for negative ones in the Brahmaviharas, these four qualities of an awakened person, which are fully developed in an awakened person but present or available in everyone else. One of them is sympathetic joy, where we're happy for their good fortune, right? We're empathically moved by positive states of mind in them. Empathy is often communicated, but it need not be. We can feel empathic without communicating anything. And if we do communicate something, it's often tacit. It's a nod. It's a look. It's a, you know, a kind of a, oh, we go into resonance with them. And then sometimes we'll say it fairly explicitly. We can give empathy, we can receive it, and we can ask for it. Empathy is something that's often negotiated, actually, in relationships, especially long-term relationships. People come together in an intimate relationship, often based on great empathy for each other. But it's one of the common casualties of a long-term relationship, particularly when other things come along, like a major job or children. Empathy tends to really radically decline. So then to regenerate empathy, which is one of the primary ways to keep re-knitting bonds of connection in a long-term relationship, in a framework in which rust never sleeps you know, the forces of entropy are all around, disorder. They tend to pull people away from each other. We have to keep knitting connections actively, constructively, to stay together in a long-term relationship. One of the major ways to do that is through empathy. So then empathy can become something that's negotiated where you start to name it. And you start talking about what you'd like more of and how you'd like it to be expressed or how to give it. It can become a topic to be negotiated. And one way that really helps do that is, of course, to understand it deeply yourself. So I want to talk a little bit about empathy in Buddhist practice and then talk about empathy in the brain. All right? In Buddhist practice, empathy is very interesting. I'm not sure that word is very present in the Pali Canon. You find words like compassion or loving kindness. And yet, if you think about it, empathy really sees how we're all related to each other. It really expresses wise view. It's also restraint. Sila is restraint. That's the second bullet point there. Morality, where we don't just act out our own infinite wisdom or push our own point of view on another person, but we're present with them. We also, for the moment, drop our own view. It's non-attachment. Empathy is non-attachment in the moment. We basically go into a little bit of don't-know mind, like curiosity. Like, wow, what's happening over there? Empathy is non-harming, both in the sense that we, I'm going to put it, if not giving empathy often harms people, because they want empathy. Flip it around. Don't you want empathy? Don't you want to receive empathy? What's it like in an important relationship when you're upset about something or you want something and the other person's not empathic? It's wounding. We're social animals. It's a first dart. There's no way around it. That's a first dart when, you know, we're not getting empathy. And so flip it around the other way. If we give people empathy, we're not harming them by the harm of absent empathy. And we are guided by our deeper understanding of what's going on inside them so that we don't act unskillfully or we act less unskillfully and more skillfully. I have a bit of a bugaboo. I've talked with Tara a bit about this. I've known people, maybe it's a West Coast phenomenon, who do sort of generic compassion. Like, but the truth is, they're not moved by the other person. They're not brave enough. That's why being strong and being for yourself really aids empathy. Because you have to feel strong and centered over here to be empathic with what's happening over there, to be open, to be moved by what's happening over there. You know, to me, just being compassionate in a superficial way, like, oh, may you not suffer. News at 11. Yeah, what's for dinner? Or, oh, may you be happy. You know, where's my email? Right? That is not real compassion or loving kindness. The essence of loving kindness and compassion both are at root empathic. So a couple of key conditions for empathy, and then I'm going to talk about it in the brain. This will be very cool. To be open, we have to be able to receive other people. We also have to pay attention. You ever noticed how in a long-term relationship especially, the decay rate of attention? Like, how rapidly, how hard it is to get past a certain threshold? 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, right? I'll stick my neck out here. You know, if I had my 15 seconds on Oprah to say the two things that I think that would cut the divorce rate in this country in half, I'll say one of the two. It would be for each person to ask the other person three questions in a row every day about themselves. Three questions in a row every day about the other person's just life, how it was, what's happening. Just three questions. Three questions would really knit a lot of relationships. So we pay attention to the other person. Okay? Openness and attention.
Can one of the questions be, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. No. No, we're not going to go there. Or, did you get my shirts?
What do you think you're doing?
Thank you, Nat.
It's not just any question, in other words. Yeah.
It's very often for guys. I mean, I'll genderize it a little bit. You know, it's a good thing. I mean, women tend to ask questions about the inner states of other people. Most novels written by men are about actions, if you think of it. Most novels written by women are about internal states of mind. And so for men to ask women questions about their internal states, doesn't that make you feel closer? If you're a woman, you know, what? It goes the other way. Okay, so did it? Got to be feel strong. Neural substrates. So I'm going to do this part. You've probably heard about mirror neurons. They're basically, and I'll talk how we talk about how we evolved this later. There are essentially three systems in you right now are fully alive and operational that help you resonate with other people. One system is the mirror-like neuron system, which has us track the actions of other people. Okay? And the mirror neuron systems are mainly in what's called the temporal parietal junction, right around here. All right. Second system is grounded in the insula. Remember I said at the very beginning today that if you meditate, the insula gets thicker? The insula is what we use to be aware of our internal state. It's also very much what we use to be aware of other people's state. In other words, to use an example, if you were to reach for a cup, certain neurons in your brain in this region would start firing. Okay, very good. If you watch me reach for the cup, about 10% of the same neurons fire. So you get a sense inside yourself of what it's like to be that person doing an action. Similarly, if you're upset about something or really moved by something, your insula will really light up. On the other hand, if you see someone over there that you care about, really moved or upset by something, some of those same neural systems in your insula will light up as well when you watch them having an emotion. So again, you're simulating, you're getting a resonance, a kind of echo inside of what it's like to be another person. Isn't this cool? It's like we evolved this. And then last, there's what's called the theory of mind systems, which come online last, that are more centered in the prefrontal cortex, that have to do with theorizing or psychologizing about the intentions. Remember those attribution of intentions? Or the psychodynamics, or the personality traits, or the gender issues, or the personal history needs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, of the other person. Those are these three systems. And they interact with each other. They're automatic. In other words, we're continually generating a semblance of other people's inner states. A lot of that is below the conscious level. That's why we get a vibe from people, you know? They develop. It's interesting, young children don't have much theory of mind. In other words, you know, till their age around 4, 5, or 6, especially theory of mind circuitry comes online ultimately in early adulthood, you know? It's the last to come online in a person's development. It's also the most recent in an evolutionary phylogeny kind of sense. It's also true that theory of mind is the first to go as people dement or get old. They lose theory of mind. On the other hand, they still have these very neurologically deep resonance circuits of empathy with the feeling states of other people. That's why I think when I realized this, it made me very attentive to, I don't work a lot with older people, but if and when I do, particularly demented people, I'm going to be very attentive to my emotional orientation toward that person who's picking up on it, even if they can't speak English anymore. You know? I want to say one more thing. Even though these systems are capabilities and do tend to be fairly automatically occurring, they often go offline. They can be pushed offline by stress or distraction, or just lack of use. So it's very, in other words, people talk about neural Wi-Fi. I just think that's a great exaggeration. If we were such socially attuned creatures, we would not treat each other so awfully, right? Or not be so oblivious to the inner state of other people, or feel so frequently that people are just, you know, completely out of touch with what's going on with us, and they are, right? So these are systems that are an incredible endowment of evolution, but they're very affected by training and use, so which gives us a great opportunity to develop our empathy skills so that we can be more present and get the benefits of empathy for ourselves and to give those benefits to others in our relationships. And that's what Tara's going to now talk about, which is how to cultivate those skills and then, of course, practice them.
Yeah, so I was just thinking as you were talking, Rick, about how if, you know, they're in there, we've got this capability, but of course we have to cultivate it, and they do get obscured. And one of the extreme expressions of that is with trauma. And when we get traumatized, when a whole lot of fear rushes through, and when it really locks in, and Rick can speak of this more eloquently than I can, but that a lot of the pathways to our frontal lobes and towards whatever would help to relax us are cut off. Part of what's cut off, because trauma means cutting off. In other words, all that we have access to is our pure survival, reptilian, you know. We're cut off. Part of what's cut off is empathy. We can't feel our own body, heart, mind states in any sort of an empathic way, and we certainly can't feel others. We're cut off. So this kind of a training is, what, to whatever degree we're cut off, and we all, to different degrees, forget and lose touch with these basic capacities to be attuned. For each of us, there's an incredible freedom that's possible when we get intentional about it. Okay? Almost every one of us experienced empathic breaks growing up, that our caregivers got preoccupied, whether it's because they were stressed or traumatized. And trauma, by the way, is incredibly common. Because of that, we did not get that kind of mirroring that actually creates a resonant field that allows us to relax and be whole. I have a cartoon here. It's one of my favorites. Maybe I should leave it up here. It's got this little boy, and he's got a mask on, and he's firing into the wall these letters. It says, "I need love." He's on a little ladder, and his mother's talking to her friend. He's just doing that to get attention. That's empathic break. So there's a training, and it's a really training in how to track another person. And I'd like to describe this training of attention in terms of RAIN, since many of us are familiar with using RAIN to begin to track internally. And the first portion of RAIN, which is to recognize, are to be able to look at another person's face, another person's expression, their eyes, and to begin to use that to sense what's going on for this person. In other words, to recognize the feelings that are there by tracking somebody's face. And as Rick said, we have the neurological machinery within us to do that. The other element of recognize, and this is one step deeper, is look behind the eyes. And this is not intellectual. This is feeling tone, where you feel who's there behind the mask, because every one of us has developed a mask to make it through. We all have kind of a hardness. The muscles of our face have tightened in ways to kind of block recognition. Most of us have a belief that we have to present ourselves in a certain way to be loved and respected. Look behind the mask of that presentation to feel into the vulnerability of who's here. That's the recognize piece, okay? We're going to go to the next piece, which is in RAIN, you'll notice, remember, it's allow. What happens as we're with somebody, and this is in therapy, it's called counter-transference, and it's what every one of us knows, is that some of what that a person's experience can trigger off aversion. In other words, we might recognize, oh, that person's feeling ashamed, but a part of us goes, yuck, you know, we just don't like that. So allow means to recognize your own response and to really have the intention to create a space to let what's going on inside you go on and to allow that being to be how they are. Recognize and allow. This is the core. This is the core piece of empathy, both within our own being and with another. Look at the other person's face, their eyes. Look behind the eyes. Feel what's there and allow it. Okay. Now, what's the next part of RAIN? Investigate. Rick talked, and I think he framed it really beautifully, about how there's not just the feeling of empathy, there's a way that we have some cognitive understanding of it, and we go back and forth between kind of sensing our guess of what's going on with our mind and feeling into it. We use both the frontal lobes and our more feeling limbic equipment. So when we investigate, we're really inquiring, what is it like for this being? What is it like to be them? In this moment, what's it like? So the language of this is often start forming some guesses in this investigation, because you're going to be expressing something, especially in this exercise we're doing, and your guess is really about what's going on. And for me, I'm often looking, what is this person feeling, and what's the need? What does this person need? Sometimes what this person needs is to, you know, the need that's being expressed is this need for freedom or full realization. And sometimes it's a need to be seen. And it could be anything in between. There's tons and tons of needs. But to sense, as you're looking and as you're recognizing and allowing, the feelings and the needs, and begin to form kind of a guess about that. Now, the other part of investigating, as many of you know, is the quality of intimacy, right? You remember that? So that's where, as you're guessing, it requires a quality of heart resonance, where you're really sensing, if this was me, what would I be feeling? What would I be needing? Without a tenderness, you can't really guess. I don't mean a kind of oozy-gooey, you know, but without a quality of care, of real interest. To me, one of the most powerful teachings that guides me in this is that attention is the purest expression of our love. That the training in empathy is a training in paying attention, and it's a training in love. And that through this process, what I'm using the initials RAIN just to see if that might help you. There's other ways you could organize it, of really recognizing, oh, what's happening, this phase, what's behind. And that allowing, that really, the equanimity that's not reacting. And that deepening investigation, guessing, what does this person need? In feeling what it would be like to be you, we then come to the end, which is really a natural empathic presence. In RAIN, you'll recognize that it was either non-identification or natural awareness. You're no longer identified with your separate self. There's a kind of a presence that really includes another. So in a moment, we're going to do an empathy exercise, but I'd like to pause and see if you have questions for either of us about really what empathy is or how to begin to track empathy. The piece that I didn't mention that I just want to throw in is that in this exercise, after you've done the attending, and you'll be listening to your partner, one person will speak and the other person will empathically listen. You who is empathically listening will have some moments to speak what you've understood or what you've guessed. And it's not a test to see if you're right, but more of an opportunity just to name out loud what it was like to sit there and listen to a person. So the shape of this exercise will be one person will speak, another will practice what I've been describing as empathic listening, this tracking. And after the person's finished speaking, the person who's listening will just have a little bit of time to express their guess, their understanding. And it might be something like, it seemed to me that you were feeling such and such and that you were needing such and such, or maybe you were feeling this and feeling this. Or it might even be, as you spoke, I was feeling this, and maybe that's, you know, it'll be some expression of what you've noticed. So, questions. We have one over here.
Sometimes empathy can have an effect of, or a similar effect, like a vortex. It can really suck you into it. I was just wondering, it almost feels like you're losing yourself. And so, how do you still stay empathetic without, and separate yourself without becoming cold? And it seems like a really fine line to to not get sucked into it and not find your way out of this vortex.
Yeah, that's a great question, because being sucked in isn't actually empathy. It's being sucked in. Rick really gave, I think Rick's grounding exercise of, you know, really feeling your own strength and being there for yourself. In other words, really taking the time to anchor right here in this moment, in this body, in this heart. And you might need to come back to it over and over. And when I'm practicing empathic listening. Like when I was just listening to you, I was trying to listen and sense where you're coming from and the concern, but I was also constantly coming back and feeling this body, this moment right here. So for you, emphasize the grounding in your own immediate embodied experience. It's okay if you miss out on some of what's going on for the other. Ultimately, you'll actually take the other being in a more truthful way if you are established here in your own being. That's the emphasis for you. For others, we're so stuck in ourselves that really, really drawing in the other, that there's a little bit of a different emphasis. Does that make sense?
That was really well said. I myself visualize a picket fence, perhaps between me and another person, if I'm just getting too flooded by, or like a glass wall that's 6 inches thick. And particularly if I'm empathizing with, like anger, particularly if it's toward us. We haven't really talked much about that. It's possible to empathize with states of mind in other people when they're mad at us, you know, and that's actually really powerful to be empathic when they're finding fault with us, unjustly, no less, you know? And so what helps me do that in part, you know, it's the old saying, it's a great one, fences make for good neighbors. Paradoxically, the boundary enables a sustaining connection. So that helps me too. Little visuals like that.
Okay, yeah, and that will be the more, that's more advanced. And we, in order to train yourself, you start with when somebody's not directly forcing you to have to negotiate with something coming at you. That's as a training grounds. But Rick's absolutely right, to really widen the circles, and this will be the end of the day, to really widen the circles. It doesn't matter whether their target is you or wherever, how to really open in a caring way. Yeah.
When you're investigating, how it seems to me that it's easier to start projecting your ideas about someone's intentionality in doing something to you and kind of making it all about yourself and they always do this because blah, blah. Is there some skillful means for suspending? I mean, because the end doesn't come till afterwards. not taking it personally. And
yeah,
do you understand what I mean?
Yep. So here's, it's again, the where empathy can go into, the shadow side of empathy is projection, obviously, that you're taking your reality and imposing it on someone, and that's almost an aggression. That's almost a violation. So what helps to allow you to come back home to a more empathic presence, a couple of things. One is the attitude is don't know mind. It's real interest, like a real curiosity, like I've never encountered this particular unique creation of a being before, and what's true for this being? And the more sincere your interest is, the less you'll be liable to collapse into your old configurations of projection. That's one. The other is, you know, is to keep putting aside thoughts. You know, you can come to some guesses that have a cognitive form without going into a whole chain of thought that's your familiar cocoon of thinking things out, and you'll start to notice the difference. Does that make sense? That let me give you an example that I can hear what you're saying and really guess that. Okay, so that has happened to you before. I can feel that that's happened to you before and that there's been some trouble with that, with being with somebody and either having somebody do that to you or you all the time. Okay. So I could sense that, but I didn't go into a whole long thing of, you know, what that means and how that happens to me and so on. It was just oh yeah, that's something familiar to you. And if we were talking more, I'd want to know more about how that was for you without adding more of my ideas. Interest, yeah.
I get it. One thing, as a couples counselor, I've seen people who have a freaking PhD thesis about each other's psychology,
yeah.
Right? And they are deeply embedded in their case and their thesis about the other person's mind. And defending their own mind against this critique that's coming at them, and round they go, right? And it's very problematic. But in fact, they have almost no idea of what's really going on in the other person. And each of them feels deeply that the other person, their partner, has no idea of what's really true in their heart, deep down. Mm. And very often, what feels most painfully misunderstood are people's positive intentions deep down. Mm-hmm. Which was, this Tara used this lovely word, need. She tried to track the need in the other person, the fundamental need, the wholesome desire deep down in the other person. Maybe expressing itself or being pursued in problematic ways, all right. But deep down, a wholesome desire. So to really, it helps us be empathic and not get sucked into the whirlpool, the eddies, if you will, of our theories about the other person, to keep trying to sense down into what are the deep wants? What are the deep wants? Because all the deepest wants are always positive. So I just want to underline sensing into the deep want of the other person. And then also, we'll get into later, helping the other person apprehend our own deep want. Mm-hmm. You know, and to be on our own side to help other people understand the goodness in us that may have been coming across badly. Like, it's a goodness in me. I'm coming home. I've been on the road for about 4 weeks. I want someone to pick me up. It's okay. I miss my family. I don't want to do one more round of travel madness on the way home. You know, that's understandable. And to try to help them understand that. If we could just speak the wholesome yearnings in the heart deep down at first, rather than make a case, right? Things would go so much better. And so I think the reason we make our case is because it's a defense. You know, Psych 101, but I think we're defending a lot against the vulnerability. And I think we're hypnotized by the trance of it. We're caught in the case. And paradoxically, I think in a context in which we're for ourselves and have healthy boundaries, where we really focus on zeroing out the maximum reasonable complaint in our partner, one by one by one, it is really hard not to get along well with someone who's doing that with you. Do you know? Who's going after what's maximally reasonable in the other person's issue and handling it. Bam. And moving on. That is a very powerful way. In other words, most people are focused in relationships on how you could be a better partner to me. Right? That's like 90% of their attention is on how you could be a better partner. 10% is on, well, what might be grudgingly possibly true in your stupid complaint that was badly expressed about me. But, all right, I'll be gracious. Maybe there's a little about me. All right. That's the norm, right? Doesn't work. What works is to invert it. To be 90% focused on how I can be a better partner. And 10% speak my truth, say what I think could go better over there, but once it's said, move on. But mostly focus over here. Wow, that's incredibly powerful. Makes you feel good, it's energizing, puts you on the high moral ground, because after a few weeks, if you've been operating that way, well, honey, you got to admit it, you know, maybe it's your turn too. It's a very powerful thing to do. That's an incredibly powerful thing to do. And there you are in the interaction. And people can feel it when that's your intention. That's what's so central is we sense the intention of the other person. If you're in the argument to try to figure out how to do it better and differently and what your learning is, what your takeaway is, what your correction is for the future, the other person can feel it. And then you unilaterally get to decide what's the maximum reasonable responsibility you can take, maximum reasonably legitimate correction you can put in for the future. You do it and you move on. You see what I mean? People can really feel that and it makes things go so, so much better.
What they most feel is when you sincerely are seeking to understand who they are. And I look at empathy as mostly an undoing of our old habits of laying on our understandings or trying to prove our point and really seeking to understand. So when you do this exercise, if that's all you go in with is the intention of, may I seek to understand who is this being, that sincerity will allow the rest of it to unfold.
Maybe one more and move on?
Yeah.
How do you get past the anger into the empathy? That's the first question. And secondly, in the example you gave about your trip, you obviously went into the anger and then you got to the empathy. How did you do it?
A couple things. One, I think about, because I'm not yet enlightened, I think about healthy fighting usually often it's like a trajectory, like a healthy fight versus an unhealthy fight. You know, a healthy quarrel, initially both people are kind of sputtering. Now, on this one, my wife was awesome because she hit the ball over the net neutrally. I hit it back with some negative topspin. Okay, game on. In a normal situation, she would have gotten fiery and then really ripped it back to me, right? That's the normal. Isn't that kind of normal? All right. She was cool. She just went all zen on me or whatever she did, and she was completely cool about it. So now, in a normal interaction, there is a certain amount of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But in a healthy quarrel, usually within a few cycles, within a few minutes, ideally if not sooner, one of the two people, if not both of them, are thinking internally, wow, this is painful, this is awful. The Buddha's metaphor is getting angry with people is like throwing hot coals with our bare hands. Both people get burned, you know. One person at least starts to think, I don't like this. This is an affliction on me. It's not helping. How do we get out of this? What is the correction I need to put in? And then empathy starts to begin. But it's often motivated by being for ourselves and through understanding. We start to realize that being identified with our case, making our case, is bad for ourselves. Do you see? In other words, we're not talking here about becoming a doormat and just walk all over me. It's realizing that by pounding my point home, I hurt myself. Okay. And then ideally, both people start realizing that. And if one person realizes it and starts acting accordingly, it helps the other person realize that. And then then you come down into some kind of healing and reconciliation. You move on. And often it happens in 90 seconds, right? Or in 3 emails. Sometimes it takes a few weeks, sometimes longer, but that's part one. Part two is to take on in general anger. I took a precept internally about 3-4 years ago, I forget, I'm not good on time, probably longer actually, where I internally realized, I took the precept of, I will never speak or act out of anger with my children and as many people as possible. And I'm a mellow guy, I really am a mellow guy, and so I wasn't like some rageaholic, but what was interesting was how on that first day, I violated that precept probably 20 times, in little ways. You know the little ways? Like, watch this. Like, you do something, the eye roll way, right? Or the tone of voice way, or the, you know, exasperated correction way. A lot of little ways that were fundamentally driven by anger. So paying a lot of attention, the Buddha paid a lot of attention to anger and ill will. Put a lot of focus on that because it is so corrosive in relationships. I think there's a place for anger. There's this place for being fired up around social justice and for using it as a vehicle, but the acting out of it is problematic. So I think understanding that and really taking anger on, qua anger, anger as anger, is a really good practice. And then the last thing about it is taking care of your own legitimate needs. Often we're angry because we have been shorted. We're not being cared for, you know. If I had just sucked it up and said nothing, I probably would have been pissed off landing in Oakland. You know? I took care of my needs. I didn't do it perfectly well. But I was trying to take care of my needs at least. And it's really important to take care of the things that make us angry. You know? And to try to do what we can for ourselves.
Just to mention that in this culture, anger is so taboo that we usually, even when we feel righteous, some part of us feels ashamed and doesn't like ourselves. And to me, when I get angry, one of the first things I do is say forgiven, forgiven to the fact of the anger. Like, just like, oh, it's a weather system that's in me. I forgive the anger. And that feels really important because when there's a layer of not only is something wrong with you, something's wrong with me for feeling anger, I can't end up bringing a full presence to what's going on. So I'll forgive the anger and then just let the energy be there. And then as Rick was describing, there's always a need underneath it. There's something in that wants attention. So in the movement from anger to empathy, the first place of attention is to what's underneath the anger, and it's usually hurt or fear. And if I take the time to forgive the anger, which allows me to get under it to what's there, and then bring a presence and an empathy to the hurt or fear that's there, that field of empathy then can include the other person. always start with what's inside you. Don't, whether it's forgiveness, acceptance, or empathy, the first place of attention is with the knots and the tensions and the tightness and the hurts in our own body heart.
Yeah, and if I could just build on that and clarify very briefly. I'm not saying not be angry. This practice may not be of interest to you. For me, it was wonderful because it slowed me down and made me speak more from my heart. It's that we don't act out of anger. You know, we act out of wisdom. We act out of compassion. We act out of caring. We act out of love, whatever. But we don't act out of anger. We may name the anger that's there, but we don't name the anger out of anger. You know? And last, I'm sure Tara's talked with you about this. Nonviolent communication is a wonderful structure, particularly when the wheels start coming off. It boils down to three things. You know, when X happens, describe neutrally, not when you're an asshole. No. When you sent me that email about how I had to take BART and then a train, you know, I felt that. So when X happens, I felt Y, not I felt you were an idiot, but rather I felt sad, I felt afraid, I felt unloved, because I need Z, right? Because I need to feel cared about or like I matter. Or I have a voice in this relationship or whatever. You know, that structure, you don't have to do it robotically, but if things are getting a little weird, it's great to go back to. You know, when X happened, I feel Y because I need Z. And then sometimes add, so from now on, I request such and such. I mean, if you think about it, most quarrels are arguments about the past. Right? What happened, how bad it was, whose tone was used, you know, who was right, who was wrong, blah, blah. And what's much more effective is to focus on agreements for the future, understandings for the future, requests for the future. Sometimes just do the XYZ, but sometimes it's useful to follow it with a request from now on. In that structure, people, it's really interesting, they tend to not want to do the pure form, but the pure form is really valuable, especially when the wheels are coming off. In that book by Marshall Rosenberg, Nonviolent Communication, it's really good, really accessible, I think. We better swing back to empathy. I've really kind of freelanced here. I really wonder what Tara's thinking. But anyway.
Oh, I'm empathic towards your freelancing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So we're going to practice in a moment. These are the words of George Washington Carver. He says, "How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and the strong, because someday you will have been all of these." So we are going to, in a few moments, find partners and practice together. And I just want to really invite you in advance to approach this with a curiosity and not in any way that this is like some test to see how well you can do something. It's a real an opportunity to seek to understand another person. And you'll each have a chance. First, I'm going to ask one person to share something for a couple of minutes, some recent experience that in some way was important to you. That had some intensity, some meaning to you. I'm going to ask the other person to listen, and I'll remind you again of ways to pay attention. Then we'll let you know when that time's up. The person who is listening will have a chance to express what they noticed empathically, tell you when to stop, and then the person who was speaking will have a chance to say, yeah, it was like that, but it wasn't quite like this, to kind of, you know, just say, here's what really it was like for me. And then you'll switch sides. Okay? So that's going to be the sequence. But you don't have to have anything. If it just sounded like gobbledygook just now, you'll be walked through every stage of this. Okay? Oh, some people might have come here with a partner today, and it's fine to be with that person or someone else, and many, many of you didn't, and you'll just be finding a partner. Even before you find partners, just ask you to pause right now and just close your eyes for a moment. And just, this is really an opportunity just to check in and be right here in the moment with what's going on for you. There have been a lot of words. There's been a lot of content about really how we are in this world with each other. So just take a moment to be intimate with how it is right here. in some moments in this meditation on empathy together, each of you will have an opportunity to speak. And you'll be speaking about something, as I mentioned, that is important to you for 3 minutes. So you might reflect right now, just take some moments to sense what it is, some subject that you'd like to talk about with your partner, just to tell your partner about, that's important to you, that you have significant feelings about. Something that happened recently or a long time ago or something that's going on right now. It could be significant positive feelings or significant troubled, distressed feelings. And decide how deep or intense you want to go. Mostly it's recommended not something traumatic, something more in the middle. Something that after 3 minutes it's going to be okay to stop talking about. So to take care of yourself as you just sense what is the thing that would be valuable to speak on right now. So in a moment we'll be shifting gears, and I'd like to say that because this is a meditation on empathy, that even when you find your partners, let's keep the talking down to a minimum, just to find somebody to work with, and then if you will, to spread out through the room some, so that you're given the numbers here as well spread as possible, so you'll be able to hear each other, okay? So when you're ready to open your eyes, to take a few full breaths, and then once you've found a partner, come sitting with each other and then come into quietness again, and we'll give you some more guidelines and instructions. Okay? Okay, and once you have found your seat, and once you have found your partner, let's come into silence and I'll give you the next instructions. The next instruction is a simple one. One of you is going to be A and one of you is going to be B. And that's going to tell us when I speak who's going first and this and that. So if you could just through this, you know, very gracious pointing, who's going to be A and who's going to be B? Can you figure that out in about 5 seconds? Okay, good. Thank you. You got that one. I'm assuming that half the people in here are A's. Is that right? All it means right now is that A, you will be the first person to speak, that for 3 minutes you're going to be speaking. But again, I'd like to invite you just to kind of check in, because empathy arises out of presence. So feel your body, feel yourself right here. So the way we're going to do this is, as I mentioned, person A is going to be speaking for 3 minutes, and I'll let you know when to stop. Just in any guidelines for speaking, or really just see if you can stay with your body, stay with your heart, speak what's true for you. Listener, as you practice empathy, if your sincere intention is to understand, the rest will follow. You're basically trying to recognize, looking at the person's face, eyes, behind the eyes, what it's like to be having this experience. What are the feelings, the needs? And just trust that your attention is the most deep expression of caring. If as your partner is speaking during those 3 minutes, there's a brief question that comes up for you that might help you to understand more. Just a small question. You don't want to kind of occupy too much of the space. It's fine. You can ask a question like, you know, could you say a little more about that? Or what was that like for you? Or how did that feel? Those are good questions, but just briefly. But mostly you're listening. And then at the 3 minute mark, I'm going to ring the gong. You're going to come into silence. I'm going to have you just be still for a moment. So there's a lot of pausing and checking in. And then I'm going to invite the listener for a minute and a half to say a bit of what you noticed empathically. And again, the form of it, there's different ways, but it mostly can be, it seemed like, or I noticed that you were feeling this and perhaps you were needing that. Or when I listened to you, I felt a sense of vulnerability or excitement or this or that, and I wonder if you are having this experience. In other words, your guess about really some more of what was going on for that person. That'll be for a minute and a half. I'll gong again. You'll be quiet again. And then there'll be a chance for person A to say, yeah, actually you're listening and what you noticed and guessed was pretty right on. Or actually it was more like this or that. Okay? So that's going to be the process. Now let me check in with you and see if, and trust that I'll let you know what's going on at each stage. Any questions right now? Because if you have a question, other people will have it and it'll help to have some clarification.
Is it normally be afraid?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, let's have a hand raise. How many people are nervous? Yeah. Okay. So let me just make a comment. In this practice, it's a very intimate practice. It's very intimate, and we are rigged to be nervous around intimacy. So be forgiving. Like right from the start, if you can just in some way not make that wrong, and I really am grateful to you to say that, to not make it wrong, all of a sudden we become part of this field together. Okay? To not make wrong whatever you're feeling right now as you're approaching this. Okay? So any other questions? Okay, let's again take a pause. To check in, to feel your body. Let me invite you to feel your breath. For you who's going to speak, just to sense the simplicity of expressing what's real for you. And you who are listening, bottom line, to be caring or interested in understanding your partner. Just that. Okay? Please begin. I know it feels quick. Okay, so take a few breaths and come inside. Check in. These pauses can be really revealing if you just gently bring yourself right here. Sense the pathway home right in this moment. And just a few moments. You who are listening will have just a short time just to say a bit about what it was you noticed in seeking to understand. What you felt, what you guess. Okay, opening your eyes and please begin. Okay, just take a pause for a moment. Just take a moment to breathe and be right here in quietness. So this is an opportunity for person A to say what it was like to be listened to and whether your partner was, guesses were accurate, and just take some time together to say, what was that like? What was that like? Okay, let's begin again, just to share with each other. Okay, again coming into quietness. You'll have a chance to talk with your partner a little more casually after this at the break. So just to stay with the meditation. Again, close your eyes and come inside because you're going to be switching in a moment. And I want to give you the time to just really inhabit your presence right here. Now in switching, person who is B is going to be sharing for 3 minutes something that matters to you. And now A, you're the listener. And just to keep it simple, you're listening out of that interest to understand. Listening, watching, feeling, taking in the other person. Okay, let's begin again. Yeah, so finishing your words, and again, get this habit of this pausing, like just sense for yourself if you close your eyes what's happening right here, and if you can relax into this moment right here, right now, this breath, this body. This is the opportunity for you who are listening, who are receiving and seeking to understand, to just express a bit, kind of an empathic expression of what you noticed. Okay, please begin. Okay, the sacred art of pausing. Remember that? The sacred art of pausing. Just take a moment. And this last piece here is a chance to speak together, the person who initially was speaking, to sense what it was like to receive that empathic listening. Whether your partner guessed correctly or not, your experience of this. Okay? Okay, and then sharing together a little. Please begin. Okay, so can you, for a moment, pausing again. You're going to be able to resume speaking in a moment, but just take a few breaths and come here for a moment. We're going to have some unscheduled time for 10 whole minutes. And with that, and we're being real specific because the afternoon is going to be ending in not so long, and we want to make sure there's some pieces we want to weave together for you. So if you will, to take these 10 minutes, if you need to get a drink, go to the bathroom, or you'd like to speak with your partner, that's fine. But we're all going to be back in the room, and we're going to begin again at that time. You'll hear the bell calling you. Okay, so enjoy your break.
5 after 4. 5 after...